Welcome. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming. Do I need to hold up one hand to say, if you hear me, hold up your hand. There you go. Thank you so much for coming. I am really thrilled, beyond thrilled, actually, by the amount of people that have gathered today to hear Dr. Marjorie Agosin. Let me introduce myself. If you don't know me, I'm Trina Trotter-Nussbaum. I'm the Associate Director of EMU's Center for Interfaith Engagement, as well as a graduate student at the Center for Justice and Peace Building here at EMU. And the format today will be one of conversation. The title of today's gathering has been the Weight of Transgenerational Trauma. But I also look forward to hearing about what that means specifically for Dr. Agosin and how the weight of being the descendant of people in exile, of which she has written so eloquently about, how that's informed her poetry, her different editing of different anthologies that she's done, her human rights work with women throughout Latin America and Eastern Europe. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Agosin with a bio that I found on a very interesting website, World of Voices, a collaboration to promote cultural awareness through literature. In her life and her writing, Marjorie Agosin makes use of refusal. She refuses to forget the violent past of her native Chile, to forget her Jewish family's history of exile, or to forget her own sense of displacement. She refuses to be quiet about what she knows of atrocity through empathy or experience. But Marjorie's refusals are inherently affirmative. Her poetry, fiction, memoirs, and edited anthologies are most often concerned with fostering human rights, with a particular emphasis on the suffering and strength of Latin American women. Regardless of scope, style, or form, Agosin's work displays compassion and depicts community as a means of survival and empowerment amidst distress. Marjorie was born in Bethesda, Maryland in 1955, while her father, a doctor and biochemist, completed a 3-year tenure at the National Institute of Health. The family returned to Santiago, Chile 3 months after Agosin's birth, and they continued to live there until they fled the country in 1971 amidst rumors of an imminent military coup. They settled in Athens, Georgia, where Agosin's father eventually became a professor. The move, what Agosin terms her exile, seems an eerie reenactment of the near-constant flight of her ancestors, who were German-speaking Jews uprooted from Europe. Indeed, Agosin's displacement seems almost fated. As a young girl, she called herself Miriam, the biblical name of Moses' sister, who Agosin considered the determining figure behind the Exodus, because her name Marjorie was, quote, too strange for Chile. Her extended family's history is one of exile and suffering. Her maternal great-grandmother fled the coming Holocaust in Vienna, Austria, for Valparaiso, Chile, in 1939. Her paternal grandparents escaped pogroms in Odessa, in Russia, which is now in Crimea and at the forefront of the fight between Ukraine and Russia. A pogrom is actually a violent riot aimed at massacring and persecuting an ethnic or religious group, usually Jews, in the Russian Empire. Her grandparents escaped those pogroms and they migrated across Europe before finally landing in Chile. Marjorie's extended family, though saved from the Holocaust, found persecution in their new country, in Chile, which had an unfortunate tendency toward Nazi sympathy. Agosin's mother was raised in Osorno, in the south of Chile, where 50 local Nazi families flew swastika flags from their front door. Agosin's own exile at 16 to Georgia, in the southern half of the U.S., also enabled displacement to become a dominant theme in her poetry. And Marjorie, you said last night in your writer's read that it was an uncomfortable place to be for you. Even though you were blonde hair and blue-eyed, your accent made you an outsider in Athens. And you wrote, the sense of not belonging, of feeling constantly on the margins or even beyond them, was a constant in our lives, which little by little I learned to resolve through my writing. Agosin's unique fusion of biography, memoir, anecdote, and fiction, which she calls genealogies of memory and cartographies of love, is the prevalent style of such works as The Angel of Memory or Always from Somewhere Else. She has written 80 books and edited and poetry and many, many memoirs. And she's very prolific and a very wonderful writing, a very wonderful writer. And you show a resiliency that resonates. But the voices that you adopt in your work are actually not always familial. Much of your poetry is intimately linked to those left behind in Chile to suffer through Pinochet's brutal dictatorship. And although your family successfully escaped the political violence, you claim that your work is autobiographical in terms of empathy. Rather than recounting the atrocities perpetuated by the military regimes in Chile and Argentina, your poems honor the strength of the women who searched for their lost loved ones. And you mourn the loss of a generation of youthful thinkers, and you scold those who easily forget their struggle. You believe that a poet's role is to become the voices that ask for compassion for the voiceless victims. And one of my favorite quotes you have is, the writer in exile writes for an audience of remote phantoms. Your varied heritage make you difficult to define, which is probably why I like you, because I don't like putting writers into a box, because we are all bigger than that. And unlike other Latina writers born in the U.S. who choose to write it solely in English, you have never abandoned your native Spanish. You quote, nor did I wish to integrate myself into a multicultural or multifaceted community. I prefer to embrace a hybrid, a complex reality. I've lived in a space where borders get watered down, where writing is not so tied to place because it includes a large community of human beings. I think of myself as being from a long, narrow, and far-off country, but also as being from everywhere. Marjorie attended the University of Georgia as an undergraduate and earned her PhD in Latin American literature from Indiana University, which we learned today Dr. Mike Medley also attended at the very same time, and Marjorie says she remembers him. Her husband, Dr. John Wiggins, is also here in the back. He also attended Indiana University at the same time. We welcome him too. Marjorie has received the two highest honors presented for writers of Latin American literature, the Letras de Oro Prize for Poetry and the Latino Literature Prize. She's also been awarded the United Nations Leadership Award in Human Rights and the Gabriela Mistral Medal of Honor for Lifetime Achievement. I am thrilled and honored to present Marjorie Agosin. So this is how this will go today. Marjorie is going to remain seated, and we're going to have a conversation with all of you, and we will hear her read some of her poetry and some things that she's brought, and I will elicit questions from you guys. I would love to hear what you have to ask her. What are you interested in? What about her biography that I just read, short, and she's got so much more to offer, but what about that sparked it? Then that's wrong. I read that. Yes, you'll have to collect that. You'll have to correct that. So I will take this down here up for Marjorie to share some of her reading, and then we will open up for questions.
So thank you very much for being here, for sharing this luncheon. I feel I'm in the presence of very distinguished students, professors, and people that study trauma. It's interesting that I have worked with people that have suffered trauma, especially the mothers of the disappeared. I have written about it, and I'm going to really speak as honestly as I can, but I have not thought so much of my own trauma because I have been a doer. And you that are the experts in the field, perhaps when you do and you perhaps relieve other people's trauma, as I have done in my writing, I have healed. But I am my whole work with trauma and human rights begins from the place of art. I'm not attempting to be in the social sciences, in the medical profession, although I have worked with many medical schools who are interested in how the arts can heal patients that have suffered trauma. But I am primarily a poet. And my work with trauma is very intuitive because this is how art is. An artist may begin with a concept and an idea, but then the idea takes over and it may be something completely different than what your rational self has thought about. That means that my understanding of the arts and trauma are guided by an intuitive knowledge of the world. And I think this is the knowledge we are missing. We may have a rational knowledge, but the rationality of our world is really insanity. So another thing that I was talking to Tina about, I like the word resilience, because I grew up with a very, very happy family. And I think joy was a way to redeem ourselves from what we have gone through. And this may sound crazy, but one of the reasons I always love to go to Chile, because I laugh with my relatives the way I could never laugh anywhere else. And it's not only with people my generation, but with my young nephews. Humor has been restorative for us. At the same time, I'd like to just say that I grew up until maybe the age of 12, not knowing, for example, that my great-grandmother and her son and my grandfather, who arrived to Chile in the 1920s and was able to rescue his mother and brother in 1939, I never knew that the entire family, their family were murdered and sent to Auschwitz or Terezin in the Czech Republic. So the initial, the most beautiful, I think, years of our life, and I have been blessed with a extraordinarily happy childhood. We were not wealthy. My father was a professor of medicine. We were not poor either, but we only bought 2 pairs of shoes a year. You know, in this country, you may buy 200 pairs of shoes. Material wealth did not really matter to us, but a sense of joy of the family, the everyday. Then what also helped was that at first my parents sent us to a British school because, you know, everybody in the world speaks English and they thought we should too. But it was a nightmare of a school because it was an anti-Semitic school and they used to sing horrible songs written in medieval Spain. One of them says, "Who stole the breads from the ovens, the Jewish dogs, the Jewish dogs." You could find these songs in medieval text. And the teacher said, "Oh, this is a song. It's not offensive to Jews." But my sister and I found it offensive. We were, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8. So we were sent to a Jewish school, a Hebrew school, very secular. I'm deeply rooted in Judaism, but I'm a secular person. I follow my faith. I follow all the Jewish holidays, but I don't need organized religion to be a Jew. I question organized religion all over the world sometimes. But going to that school gave us roots, gave us a sense of belonging, gave us a sense of security. And it affirmed our history as Jewish children in a Catholic nation that was not necessarily welcoming to Jews. And unlike the United States, in Chile, either you're Catholic or nothing. Only now there are more emerging Christian communities. There is an order of the Mennonite Church, Mormon, Jehovah Witness. But at the time I was growing up, there was nothing. So being almost allowed to grow up free of trauma prepared me to understand trauma and to work it out. I believe the fundamentals of psychology is that eventually one has to work. Whatever circumstances you have, to work it out, to let it evolve inside your soul. But I have worked it out through my writings. And I began working this out by exploring my own generation of people who remained in Chile while I was fortunate to be with my parents and my siblings in the United States. I did not have this survival guilt, but I felt that I needed to honor what they have done. I needed to honor their courage, their resilience. So I wrote quite a bit about the disappeared. And then the way I have worked my own trauma is perhaps to imagine the life of others, and but not to imagine it objectively, but subjectively. I share this with my students. I don't believe there's objectivity that much. I mean, you may have a blood test, and the levels of your blood test will be objective. But life is about interpretation, and interpretation is subjective. So I became very, very involved in what I was writing, to the point that I knew in the real world, not the world of the imagination, that I did not suffer the trauma that I was writing about. But in my writing, I did. So I hope there are different processes, the process of detachment and the process of the reality of the everyday. I've never been tortured, incarcerated, beat up. But when I wrote about it, I was. And that maybe has helped me understand the pain of others. A beautiful line by Susan Sontag. After the theme of the disappear, I began to think a lot about the Holocaust. And I think it happened maybe when I was 40 years old, at an age that one could comprehend the magnitude of the Holocaust. But as I grow older, I begin to comprehend the magnitude of Bosnia, of Rwanda, of Cambodia. I think you need a sense of maturity to comprehend the eradication of human life, the brutality of it. A child, or like that beautiful Syrian child that drowned in the Turkish coast, maybe he was spared. He will never live this trauma. Maybe some universal power, the power of God, spared him of a horrific life. I'm beginning to think of that. But the death of a young child with his mother and brother really shames the world. So what I'm saying is that I have explored trauma at different stages of my own life and began to understand things with unusual clarity, the clarity of age, because the past doesn't seem so distant as when you're young. The past is right next to you. And for example, I've learned that my great-grandmother, who arrived to Chile and who I had the fortune to meet, although she died when I was 8 years old, she left Vienna at the same age I am now. She was 60 years old, and she left when the whole city was burning and when the synagogues were burning. And that is something to me very, I can imagine her now and understand her much more than when I actually saw her as a young girl. But what I would like to say that as an artist, I have been thinking about her for a long time, not only as my great-grandmother, but as a character of history. Now, I've always known, and we don't talk about it, but my family was caught in the most extraordinary events of the 20th century, the pogroms where my grandfather fought for Tsar Nicholas in the Russian army for 25 years. He stuttered. That's how he maybe internalized his trauma. Then he went to Chile, and he left his wife, my grandmother, with five children in Marseille, France. My father was born in France. I was born in Marseille. I mean, we have nothing to do with the French, but, you know, they were escaping. And then you were born wherever you were at the moment. And then my grandmother waited with her five children for 5 years till they found my grandpa sent them the tickets to arrive to Chile. These are quite traumatic stories. One young woman, my grandmother from Odessa, with her five children in a boat to an unknown country with a feeling of tremendous vulnerability. But what really saved all of us and helped us was the tremendous capacity to tell stories. And I think that's the key to survive, the narrative. It could be the narrative of your own life. It could be a narrative that you imagine. And, you know, in this country, I always feel people are so concerned with the truth. When I think people lie like crazy, especially the politicians, yes, maybe some priests, some rabbis. But if you imagine a narrative that allows you to be safe, there's nothing wrong with that. And I think we have to begin to revise what is truth. Not that you will have horrific historical lies, but if the truth works for you and it allows you to be free, why not? Because in my family, they told many stories about their arrival. All their stories were different. But what mattered was that they arrived to safety. So to end this, what has saved my family is the ability to speak, is the ability to say no to silence, is the ability to laugh. And the deep awareness that I feel every single day of my life that I'm alive, that I have not died yet. I feel it. I felt it as a young girl. That death looms and it's going, she, because death in Spanish is female, it's la muerte, that is going to come get you. But the idea that I was spared from a catastrophe that has been so close to me. And instead of making this a source of terrible sorrow, I have transformed that into joy. The Jewish people, I think, with other peoples of the world, maybe the Africans, maybe slavery, have been tremendously persecuted. I don't know anybody who has been so persecuted. But at the same time, there's so much resilience. There's this little country of Israel that has tremendous problems, and I hope they solve the problem, especially the Palestinian Gaza problem, because in a way they are our brothers and our cousins. But it's a country that thrives on ideas, the intellectual life, the stock market, music, poetry. And I think Israel, in a way, is a metaphor for the Jews. The Jews that are resilient, the Jews that have survived, and the Jews that have returned home. I know that many people in the world think that the Jews should not have a home. We do have a home. The problem is that other people were also there when we began with our home, so we have to share the home. But all people in the world should have a homeland. So all of these ideas that I've shared with you have kind of made me the poet that I am. And of course, most writers, I would like to say, Latin American writers, European writers, some North American writers write about what has affected them, what they feel deeply about. I am not a person that likes to write too much about personal things because I don't think it's that essential if one day you're sad, one day you're happy, one day you're married, one day you're divorced. Who cares about that? I want to write about deeply important things. Maybe people say that gossiping is a waste of time. In South America, people gossip a lot because it's a way to understand others. But I don't consider that a waste of time. But I want to write about what matters. I want to write about this refugee crisis, about this young child, but I can't write it now because it's so raw in my emotions that I need a little bit of emotional distance to construct a poem about it. But I do hope that I will be able to do it one day. I am an artist. I don't count how many books I've done. I'm just compelled to write. It's like a well, like Miriam's well. One day it may dry, one day it may begin to flow again, but I don't worry about it. I live more in the now, and I don't look back at what I wrote. I just write a little bit for the future. So I don't know if now if you would like to, and I have to say I've never been to a I don't think it's important to go, but I've never been to a psychologist or a psychiatrist to speak about the trauma, myself, my family. But all psychiatrists talk to me about their trauma, and I just listen. So this is my story. So if you have questions, and then...
We have a roving mic. We also could... If you'd like to read some poems, we could do that as well. Does anybody have a question right off the bat here? Or would you like to have her read a poem?
My mother always says, why do you write about such sad things when you are a happy child? So that's these books. Okay, I'll read the Spanish and Tina will read the English. This is about a collection of poems about Anne Frank. Ha visto a Ana Frank correr trasmutada en las orillas de todas las huerfanías. La han visto para abrirle un trocito de puerta, prestarle una manta, guardar sus secretos, cobijarla. ¿Alguien de ustedes ha visto a Ana Frank con su vestido manchado de sangre?
Have you seen Anne Frank running transfigured on the sheer edge of orphanhood? Did you crack your door for her, offer her a blanket, receive her secrets, shelter her? Have any of you seen Anne Frank in her bloodstained dress? This is from a collection of poetry called Dear Anne Frank, and this is a poem called Amsterdam.
Todos vienen a visitar mi casa. Soy Ana Frank, una niña judía que creía en los hombres buenos. Estoy muerta. Desde que incendiaron mi pelo oscuro, estoy muerta. Desde que me robaron el diario de mi vida, sin embargo, todos estos visitantes acuden a mí con frecuencia y no me ven. Tampoco a mi mamá, silenciosa, sometida, parecida a un pájaro errante, protegiéndome de mis sueños. acarreando muy de madrugada unas cubetas de agua. Soy Ana Frank. Tengo 13 años, pero también miles de años. Tengo el olor a humo y ancianidad que cubren los rostros del miedo. Algunos visitantes dicen que el rostro no es de una mujer judía, pero soy judía. ¿Aún no lo sospechan? En este anexo derramé un collar de palabras. Aprendí a hurtadillas a contemplar el cielo. También con gran dificultad aprendí a amarrarme los zapatos. Soy Ana Frank, estoy muerta, pero para ustedes viva. Aún tengo tanto miedo, no puedo con mi cuerpo, aplastado por la neblina de las infamias. Si tan solo pudiera llegar a la claridad para afirmarme con la luz de una flor. Si tan solo pudiera ver el rostro de mi madre.
Everyone comes to visit my house. I am Anne Frank, a Jewish girl who believed in the goodness of men. I am dead since they burned my dark hair. I am dead since they stole my diary. And yet all these visitors who frequently call on me don't see me. Not even my silent, submissive mother, resembling an errant bird, protecting me from my dreams, lugging buckets of water at the crack of dawn. I am Anne Frank. I am 13 years old, but I am also thousands of years old. I smell of smoke and old age covering the faces of fear. Some visitors say my face is not that of a Jewish girl, but I am Jewish. Is it that they don't even suspect it? In this annex, I strung out a necklace of words. I learned by stealth to contemplate the sky, also with great difficulty, and I learned to tie my shoes. I am Anne Frank. I am dead. But for you, I am alive. Even though I am terribly afraid, I can't be with my body crushed under a fog thick with infamies. If only I could have reached the sunlit clearing to affirm myself with the light of a flower. If only I could see the face of my mother. I find after hearing your poems, I have to have quite a few moments of silence. There's something so deep about the images that you present that there aren't words even possible.
And I think the silence we are all experiencing is really the power of art and the power of poetry, the power of music, the power of a painting, which is the power of beauty, which is really the power of faith and the power of God.
Does anybody have a question that they would like to ask Marjorie? Marjorie said if you also would like to talk about your own work, some work that you've done in trauma healing or something that's worked for you in your organization or in your studies, she would love to hear that as well.
I want to say my son is in film. He lives in Los Angeles, but we are both crazy about Steven Spielberg for different reasons. I saw a documentary of Spielberg when they asked him how he created Schindler's List. And he said that one day he was in Auschwitz, and this is absolutely true, the smoke was there, the ashes of the dead, real ashes, not metaphorical. And he said that those ashes called him to create the film, that they called him, that the dead called him. I feel this is my calling too. Anne Frank has come to me so I can speak with her. I feel my great-grandmother, I mean, this is of course metaphorical, but other people may not think it's metaphorical. It may be real. I feel my great-grandmother has called me to find her. So now, you know, I'm a very down-to-earth, I'm a very practical person. I'm not at all crazy. But I know that this is the terrain of art. There is something unexplainable and mysterious. And perhaps this is what all of you that are studying conflict resolution, that work with trauma, should explore that mystery. And the possibility of bringing the dead to a different kind of life, to the life they never had a chance to lead, like Anne Frank never had a chance to be the magnificent writer she would have been.
Hi, I'm Adriana Rojas. I am a professor in the Spanish department, and I just wanted to say thank you so much, Marjorie, for being here and sharing your work. And I love how you bring Anne Frank back to life. I know she's an iconic image, and we have read her books when we were in school. We know her story, but you bring her to three dimensions, you know, as a young girl, and you just do such justice to her beyond that iconic image. So thank you for that. And I just wanted to share my work as well with the audience. I finished my dissertation last year on contemporary Peruvian narrative from Manchay Tiempo to Truth, Transgenerational Trauma and Resilience in Contemporary Peruvian Narrative. And I focus on the post-conflict literature in Peru. So literature written after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and how contemporary Peruvian narrative, mainly films and novels, either engage or challenge these discourses, and how they break free from, you know, essentializing discourses produced in the 90s about the Peruvian conflict. The indictment of the perpetrators of the conflict, a change in the narrative is who were the ones causing harm, and it's just a radical shift. And also, more significantly, that ties into your work, Marjorie, is how, you know, film narrative has kind of engaged Peruvian society in talking about unspeakable acts, things that people were in denial about, and how these works provide some measure of healing after a really troubling period in Peru's history. So that's my area of study, and so thank you so much for.
So again, through literature.
Yeah, I mean, it's just challenging, bringing up new ideas, talking about shame too of Peruvian citizenry and their involvement, indifference to the conflict, but also ultimately, in the end, you know, there's hope. That we can survive, that we can heal, that we can be ourselves and move forward after this dark period of history.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Agassine, for your emphasis on resilience and stories and joy and laughter in your family. I'm interested in hearing you say a bit more about the transgenerational nature of trauma, some of the recent research on the epigenetic effect that even grandchildren of Holocaust survivors can experience change at the genetic or DNA level, and also the reenactment of trauma. Some have speculated that there's a relationship between the Shoah and the Nakba, between the Holocaust and the current occupation. Could you comment on those two issues?
The first one I'm a little bit familiar with, about the reliving of trauma through DNA. I believe it's quite possible, but I personally have not experienced. And the other question about the Holocaust and the Israeli occupation, and the way maybe second, third generation Jews feel, it could be somehow the reenactment of the trauma, but it's the reverse, because in this case the Jews are the ones that imprison. So it could be a reverse form of trauma. But these are such complex issues that people fear to talk about them. And I believe it's very interesting. The fanaticism for me is dangerous in both sides, where Jewish or Muslim, the face of a fanatic is the same. But it's very interesting that the people that have occupied the Arab lands, the Jews that have retaken the land, what they think it's their biblical right, and the majority are Americans, I may say they're American fanatics, and they are not families of Holocaust survivors. And I think that's something to study. Who are those people that lead this fanatical movement that somehow, I think, it's tearing Israel apart and the nature of what it means to be a Jew. So I also think that there are many, many Jewish intellectuals that speak about these issues and are quite against the occupation. But I think we don't know enough. These are such complex historical and emotional process that I cannot. I know that there are some stories that a young, I heard, I don't recall exactly, but a young girl in Paris always cried and fell sick the day her great-grandmother was arrested. And I think that's part of this DNA thing, this genetic understanding. For example, in Auschwitz, they want to install showers because they say it's too hot, that people want to refresh themselves. But for Jews, that is horrific. What we have done to have prisoners in Abu Ghraib with naked, reading the Quran, that's also horrific. And I think we should also think about how we as citizens of the world reenact trauma. Now, for me, when I see the Syrian refugees being taken back, I feel I'm reliving the story of my family. But look, they're Arabs. Syria has no relationship with Israel, unfortunately. Because if the world were different, they would cross the border to Israel. And that would be the best of all possible worlds. But that's how I reenact my trauma when I see the refugees or I see the young child. Not so much about the occupation, because I think I'm like a little, I am deeply aware of it, but it's not exactly my history, because I'm a Jew, but I'm not an Israeli. But the refugees touch me as if I have lived the trauma again. But one thing I'm going to say, that this is very controversial, but I'm not afraid of controversy. There's a student movement, students for Palestine. But I would like to say more movements, students against Assad, students against ISIS. And this may sound controversial, but I truly believe it, that Israel is singled out always. And Israel is very imperfect, but it's an extraordinary democracy, just like ours. We are an extraordinary country with immense faults, but this is an amazing country. But Israel is always targeted and singled out as the occupier, as the evil. Well, it may be true for some, but I think Assad is evil. I think ISIS is evil. I think the Hungarian government is evil. But I want to see the world not single out nations, but engage in a collective movement for justice without fanatical political ideologies. I think we should all get rid of our fanatisms, all of us. That's how we will change the world. But to share our religions, to share our foods, to share our history, but with a spirit of tolerance, and that's what we have to work on.
We'll make it work. Thank you so much for your sharing. One question, a simple question, just You talked about the importance of narrative, and I'm just wondering what inspiration or connection you have to the stories from your own faith tradition, from the Torah. And
recording this is why we have to use the mic.
Very interesting. Well, the Torah and the I am interested in Jewish text. I think Judaism, like other religions, is so ancient. From the Torah, I'm interested in King Solomon's Song of Songs, the ability to love God, to speak about God with sensuality, to speak about the land of Israel as some kind of a paradise. So that has inspired me a lot. Also, Miriam, who was punished by God and almost imprisoned. She had leprosy, and they told her she couldn't arrive to the promised land, but at the end she did. And I'm inspired by her ability to play the tambourine, that means by the ability of music, by the ability of poetry, and by the ability of prophecy. I think everyone is inspired by King David. He was a very mischievous king, had many love affairs, sent men to die so they could remain with their wives. But there was something about this king. There was magic. There was folklore. There was poetry. But I'm mostly inspired by the women of the Bible, by the matriarchs, by Deborah, by Sarah. And I think those are the figures that inspire me the most. I have not written too much about them, but I have written one single poem inspired in the Song of Songs, because I was so inspired by the poetry of King Solomon.
Hi, I am very thankful that you're here today, and I'm feeling very affected by the things I'm hearing, so I apologize if I'm a little shaky. I am a first-year student at the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding. I've been here 3 weeks, and the reason I came here was to learn how to be a writer. I came instead of going to an MFA program because I wanted to hear people's stories from all over, partly because I have felt that my own story didn't have enough legitimacy to write about, but I've always felt like that what I must do is be a writer. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you feel that you can be a conduit for other people's emotions or trauma or experiences or imaginations, and how you understand the legitimacy of that within yourself and with other people. And I also wanted to say that I really appreciate both your clarity of voice speaking here and also the clarity of voice that I heard when you read your poems. That's something that I aspire to and that I think is very beautiful. And I agree with you that beauty is something that can take you from the physical world to something a lot more connected and important and rich. So anyway, thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm sure you will be a great writer. And I think you made the right decision, because I don't believe in the MFA programs at all. And I think it's not that good to be among writers. They are too competitive and nasty. And all my friends are like painters or gardeners or other things, but not so much other writers, because I don't want to enter that world, like the world of the stockbrokers of the poetry world. So I think here it's very important that you are in this program, you are in this university, and that you will share this with your fellow classmates. The issue of legitimacy is fundamental, but legitimacy is not only for the arts, it's for how we conduct our lives, how we teach, how are we with our children, with our spouse, with our parents. The word legitimacy is a fundamental one. But I've always had also that thought. And for example, when I was documenting the story of the mothers of the disappeared, I always asked them, I said, well, but I have not had your story. I'm a person of education and I'm privileged because of that. But they told me it didn't matter as long as I was real. And that gave me permission to feel that if I could document their stories so other people would hear them, but not use them, not appropriate them. If I could just be like a vessel, then I would be okay. In the poems about Anne Frank, I have a conversation with Anne Frank, but I don't claim to be her. So it's okay to speak with her, but I would not write in her voice. But I think legitimacy has to do with a fundamental respect. When you interview survivors of torture, there is also a sense of what questions to ask, how to approach them. There's a sense of ethics, but all people in the field of health should have this sense of legitimacy and ethics. But I think this will come to you. And I think my students are undergraduates, so they're younger, but I mean, life just unfolds. You have to let it happen. We are very controlling, and the truth is that nothing can be controlled. So if you could just let your spirit unfold, you will find your own voice as a writer.
It's 1:00. I think we maybe have time for one more, or would you like to read another poem? It's up to you guys. Sho, you have a question?
Hi, thank you for being here. My question is about forgiveness, and as a Jewish person, whether in Chile or in Europe or even here, perhaps in the United States, whenever you encounter anti-Semitism or even the history of it, how do you deal with finding forgiveness for the oppressor or for the other, let's say, not just oppressing, but?
This Tuesday is the evening of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and we ask, and we don't ask for God to forgive us, we ask for us human beings to forgive those that we have hurt it. And I like that concept that God may be up there watching, but the ethical work has to be done by men and women. In a way, I feel an anti-Semite is a person that hates not only Jews, but hates everyone. Hates people that are different. Anti-Semitism is kind of irrational because there's a lot of anti-Semitism in Poland or in other countries where there are very few Jews, but they still blame it all on the Jews. It's something I'm used to it. Now the Iran deal will be blamed on the Jews. I look at it with humor, and I do not think that we will be obliterated from the earth. I do not think so, because we haven't yet. So this is the issue. I think forgiveness is a fundamental human activity in order to move forwards. So in a way, I have reached this point. I mean, I don't want to say I forgive the Nazis, but something in me forgives the new generation of Germans, of Austrians. But I feel that what I do is that I feel sorry for the victimizers. I feel sorry for the perpetrators because they are less than human. And in that feeling of sorry, maybe I have reached a kind of forgiveness. But basically, and this may be a very selfish reason, I have forgiven so many oppressors because I cannot carry the weight in me. I cannot carry the weight of anger and resentment. I have to let it go. And to let it go doesn't mean to forget, but forgiveness is liberating. And when you forgive your enemies, you become empowered, and somehow they cannot ever touch you again. I don't want to carry bitterness towards the Nazis, because I don't want anything of that world to touch me. I have nothing to do with such evil. And forgiveness gives me freedom.
Well, I don't quite have words to thank you for this time together. Except maybe just to say thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
I want to thank Language and Literature, and for CJP and my organization CIE and EMU Core for bringing Dr. Agosin here. It's been truly a wonderful 2 days with you. You have another event today at 4 in the Gaiman Gallery. I encourage you to go see her with Cindy Gussler, the art professor. I would imagine you'd be available to speak to anyone after here, if they would like.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to share with, I'm doing some work with the Harvard program on refugees, but the work is an artist and a physician. And I encourage you, I don't have to look at this website. If you go to Harvard Program on Refugee and Trauma, you will see a very interesting website that has a lot of art and poetry and a manifesto about how to heal in a violent world. And I can share that with you through email.
Thank you all so much for coming.